world.
O'Neill was so angry that he sent an agent to Azerbaijan to demand the actual computer from the president of the country. When that failed, he persuaded Clinton to appeal personally to the Azerbaijani president. Eventually, the FBI got the computer, but the ill will between the bureau and the agency continued unabated, damaging both in their attempts to round up the Al-Qaeda network. The CIA moved against another al-Jihad cell in Tirana, Albania, which had been created by Mohammed al-Zawahiri in the early 90s. Albanian agents, under CIA supervision, kidnapped five members of the cell, blindfolded them, interrogated them for several days, and then sent the Egyptian members to Cairo. There they were tortured and put on trial, with more than 100 other suspected terrorists. Their ordeal produced 20,000 pages of confessions. Both Zawahiri brothers were given death sentences in absentia. On August 6, a month after the breakup of the Albanian cell, Zawahiri sent the following declaration to the London newspaper, Al Hayat. "We are interested in briefly telling the Americans that their message has been received, and that the response, which we hope they will read carefully, is being prepared, because, with God's help, we will write it in the language that they understand." Despite the bluster, the media, the lurid calls for jihad, Al-Qaeda had really done nothing so far. There were grand plans and there were claims of past successes that Al-Qaeda had little or no part of. Although Al-Qaeda had already existed for 10 years, it was still an obscure and unimportant organization. It didn't compare to Hamas or Hezbollah, for instance. Thousands of young men had trained in Al-Qaeda camps and returned to their home countries to create havoc. Because of their training, they would be called by intelligence agencies Al-Qaeda-linked. Unless they had pledged their loyalty to bin Laden, however, they were not formally a part of the organization. There were fewer actual Al-Qaeda members in Kandahar than there had been in Khartoum because bin Laden could no longer support them. The fireworks displays he put on for reporters were accomplished with rented Mujahideen. Like blowfish, Al-Qaeda and bin Laden made themselves appear larger than they actually were. But a new Al-Qaeda was about to make its debut. It was August 7, 1998, the same day the slaughter commenced in Mazar-e-Sharif and the anniversary of the arrival of American troops in Saudi Arabia 8 years before. In Kenya, an Egyptian bombmaker called Salah, one of Zawahiri's men, oversaw the construction of two huge explosive devices. The first, made of 2,000 pounds of TNT, aluminum nitrate, and aluminum powder, was stuffed in boxes that were wired to batteries, then loaded into a brown Toyota cargo truck. The two Saudis who sat in on the ABC interview, Muhammad Al-Awali and Jihad Ali, drove the truck through downtown Nairobi toward the American embassy. At the same time, in Tanzania, Salah's second bomb was on its way to the American embassy in Dar es Salaam. This bomb was similar in construction, except that Salah had added a number of oxygen tanks or gas canisters to provide additional fragmentation. The delivery vehicle was a gasoline truck driven by Ahmed Abdullah, an Egyptian whose nickname was Ahmed the German because of his fair hair. The bombings were scheduled for 10:30 on a Friday morning, a time when observant Muslims were supposed to be in the mosque. Al-Qaeda's first documented terrorist strike bore the hallmarks of its future actions. The novelty of multiple simultaneous suicide bombings was a new and risky strategy, given the increased likelihood of failure or detection. If they succeeded, Al-Qaeda would make an unrivaled claim on the world's attention. The bombings would be worthy of bin Laden's grandiose and seemingly lunatic declaration of war on the United States. And the suicide of the bombers would provide a scanty moral cover for operations intended to murder as many people as possible. In this, Al-Qaeda was also unusual. Death on a grand scale was a goal in itself. There was no attempt to spare innocent lives, since the concept of innocence was subtracted from Al-Qaeda's calculations, although the Quran specifically forbids killing women and children. One of the reasons the embassy in Kenya was targeted was that the death of the female American ambassador, Prudence Bushnell, would garner more publicity. Each part of the operation betrayed Al-Qaeda's inexperience. As Jihad Ali drove into the rear parking lot of the embassy, Owale jumped out and charged toward the guard station. He was supposed to force the unarmed guard to raise the drop bar, but the guard refused. Owale had left his pistol in his jacket in the truck. He did carry out a portion of his mission, which was to throw a stun grenade into the courtyard. The noise drew the interest of people inside the buildings. One of the lessons Zawahiri had learned from his bombing of the Egyptian embassy in Islamabad 3 years before was that an initial explosion brought people rushing to the windows, and many were decapitated by flying glass when the real bomb went off. Owale abruptly faced a moral choice that he believed would determine his eternal fate. At least that was what he later told an FBI agent. He had expected to be a martyr. His death in the operation would assure him his immediate place in paradise. But he realized that his mission of setting off the stun grenade had already been accomplished. If he were to go forward to his own certain death, that would be suicide, he explained, not martyrdom. Damnation would be his fate, not salvation. Such is the narrow bridge between heaven and hell. To save his soul, Owale turned and ran, failing in his main task of raising the drop bar so that the truck could get closer to the building. Owale didn't get far. The blast knocked him to the sidewalk, shredding his clothes and pounding shrapnel into his back. When he managed to stand in the weird silence after the blast, he could see the results of his handiwork. The face of the embassy had sheared off in great concrete slabs. Dead people still sat at their desks. The tar-covered street was on fire, and a crowded bus was in flames. Next door, the Ufundi building, containing a Kenyan secretarial college, had completely collapsed. Many were pinned under the rubble, and soon their cries arose in a chorus of fear and pain that would go on for days, until they were rescued or silenced by death. The toll was 213 dead, including 12 Americans. 4,500 were injured, more than 150 of them blinded by the flying glass. The ruins burned for days. 9 minutes later, Ahmed the German drove his truck into the parking lot of the American Embassy in Dar es Salaam and pushed the detonator wired into the dashboard. Fortuitously, between him and the embassy, there was a water tanker truck. It was blown 3 stories high and came to rest against the chancery of the embassy, but it prevented the bomber from getting close enough to bring the building down. The toll was 11 dead and 85 wounded, all of them Africans. Beyond the obvious goal of calling attention to the existence of Al-Qaeda, the point of the bombings was vague and confusing. The Nairobi operation was named after the Holy Kaaba in Mecca. The Dar es Salaam bombing was called Operation Al-Aqsa, after the mosque in Jerusalem. Neither had an obvious connection to the American embassies in Africa. Bin Laden put forward several explanations for the attack. He initially said that the sites had been targeted because of the invasion of Somalia. Then he described an American plan to partition Sudan, which he said was hatched in the embassy in Nairobi. He also told his followers that the genocide in Rwanda had been planned inside the two American embassies. Muslims all over the world greeted the bombings with horror and dismay. The deaths of so many people, most of them Africans, many of them Muslims, created a furor. Bin Laden said that the bombings gave the Americans a taste of the atrocities that Muslims had experienced. But to most of the world, and even to some members of Al-Qaeda, the attacks seemed pointless, a showy act of mass murder with no conceivable effect on American policy, except to provoke a massive response. But that, as it turned out, was exactly the point. Bin Laden wanted to lure the United States into Afghanistan, which was already being called the graveyard of empires. The usual object of terror is to draw one's opponent into repressive blunders, and bin Laden caught America at a vulnerable and unfortunate moment in its history. "Now it begins," Assistant U.S. Attorney Pat Fitzgerald told Coleman when the news of the bombings came. It was 3:30 in the morning in New York when he called. Coleman got out of bed and drove immediately to Washington. 2 days later, his wife met him at a Dairy Queen on I-95 to drop off his medicine and a change of clothes. She knew he would be at SIOC for a long time. FBI headquarters assigned the embassy bombings case to the Washington Field Office, which normally handles overseas investigations. O'Neill passionately wanted control. New York had a sealed indictment of bin Laden, which gave that office the right to claim the case if he indeed was behind it. But bin Laden was still obscure, even in the upper reaches of the FBI, and the term Al-Qaeda was almost unknown. Several possible perpetrators were under discussion, Hezbollah and Hamas among them. O'Neill had to prove to his own bureau that bin Laden was the prime mover. He snatched a young Lebanese-American agent named Ali Soufan from another squad. Soufan was the only FBI agent in New York who actually spoke Arabic, and one of eight in the entire country. On his own, he had studied bin Laden's fatwas in interviews, so when a claim of responsibility was sent to several press organizations the same day of the bombing from a group no one had ever heard of before, Soufan immediately recognized bin Laden as the author. The language was exactly the same as in his previous declarations. Thanks to Soufan, O'Neill was able to send a teletype to headquarters the very day of the bombing, outlining the damning similarities between bin Laden's past statements and the demands expressed in the pseudonymous claim. Thomas Picard, then head of the criminal division at headquarters, was temporarily in charge of the bureau while Director Free was on vacation. He spurned O'Neill's request to give the New York office control of the investigation. Picard wanted to keep the probe under the supervision of the Washington office, which he formerly headed. O'Neill frantically enlisted every powerful contact he could, including Attorney General Reno and his friend Dick Clark. Eventually, the bureau bowed to the strong-arm pressure that this subordinate was able to apply. But as punishment, O'Neill was not allowed to go to Kenya personally to oversee the investigation. The bruises left by this internecine conflict would never heal. Only 8 hours after the bombings, dozens of FBI investigators were on their way to Kenya. Eventually, almost 500 would be working the two cases in Africa, the largest deployment in the history of the Bureau. On the way into Nairobi, the airport bus carrying the agent stopped for a Maasai tribesman, herding his cattle across the road. The agent stared at the congested streets, crammed with bicycles and donkey carts, dizzying scenes that were at once beautiful, exotic, and full of shocking poverty. Many of the agents were unfamiliar with the world beyond America. Indeed, some had not even been given passports until the day of their departure. And here they were, 9,000 miles away. They knew little about the laws and customs of the countries they were working in. They were anxious and watchful, knowing that they were now likely targets of Al-Qaeda as well. Stephen Gowden, a stocky redhead from the north end of Boston, took out his short stock machine gun and placed it on his lap. Until recently, his FBI career had been spent in a two-person office in upstate New York above a Dunkin' Donuts. He had never heard of Al-Qaeda. He had been brought along to provide protection, but he was staggered by the immense number of people surrounding the embassy. They dwarfed any crowd he had ever seen. Nothing looked familiar to him. How could he protect the other agents when he had no idea what was going on? The bus dropped them off in front of the smoldering ruins of the embassy. The scale of devastation was overwhelming. The building was gutted from one end to the other. Next door, the Kenyan secretarial school was completely flattened. Rescuers were digging into the rubble with their bare hands, trying to reach the wounded. Steve Gowden gaped at the ruins and wondered, what the hell are we going to do? The FBI had never solved an overseas bombing. One of the people buried under the secretarial school was named Rosalind Wanjuku Mwangi, Rosie, as everyone called her. The rescuers could hear her talking to another victim whose leg was crushed, trying to keep his spirits up. For 2 days, Rosie's encouraging voice inspired the rescuers, who worked relentlessly. Finally, they reached the man with the crushed leg and carefully worked him free of the debris. They promised Rosie they would have her loose in less than 2 hours. But when they finally did reach her, it was too late. Her death was a heartbreaking blow to the exhausted workers. The bombings were an audacious assault on America's place in the world. The level of coordination and technical sophistication required to carry out nearly simultaneous explosions was surprising, but more troubling was the willingness of Al-Qaeda to escalate the level of violence. The FBI eventually discovered that 5 American embassies had been targeted. Luck and better intelligence had saved the other 3. The investigators were stunned to learn that nearly a year earlier, an Egyptian member of Al-Qaeda had walked into the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi and told the CIA about the bombing plot. The agency had dismissed this intelligence as unreliable. This was not an isolated incident. All through the spring, there had been a drum roll of threats and fatwas from bin Laden, but few had taken them seriously. Now the consequence of that neglect was starkly evident. 3 days after the bombing, Steve Gowden's chief, Pat DeMuro, told him to check out a lead. "There's a guy in a hotel outside of Nairobi," said DeMuro. "He doesn't fit in."
"That's it?" Gowden asked. "He doesn't fit in? What does that mean?"
"If you don't like it, I got 100 other leads," said DeMuro.
Gowden and a couple of other agents drove to a shanty town largely inhabited by Somali refugees. Their truck inched along through a staring crowd and stopped in front of a decrepit hotel. "Whatever you do, don't get out of the truck," their Kenyan colleague warned. "They hate Americans here." While the agents nervously waited for the Kenyan cop to return, a man in the crowd leaned against the truck with his back to the window.
"I told you not to come here," he said under his breath. "You're going to get killed."
Gowden guessed the man was the tipster.
"Can you help us?"
he asked.
"He's not here," the man hissed. "He's in another hotel."
At the next hotel, the agents found a man who didn't fit in. A slender young Arab with several jagged stitches on his forehead and bandages on his hands that were leaking blood. He identified himself as Khalid Salim bin Rashid from Yemen. He said he was in the country researching business opportunities. He was a nut merchant, and that he had stopped at a bank near the embassy when the accident happened. The only items in his pocket were 8 brand new $100 bills.
"How did you wind up at this hotel?" the interrogator asked.
Bin Rashid said that when he got out of the hospital, a cab driver took him there. Knowing that he didn't speak Swahili, it was a place where Arabs sometimes stayed.
"Where are the rest of your things, your clothes, your identification documents?"
"Everything was lost in the explosion," Bin Rashid explained. "These are the clothes I was wearing that day." As Gowden listened to the young Arab responding to the American interrogators, he thought the story was plausible. It wasn't Gowden's place to ask questions. More experienced agents handled that. Still, Gowden noticed that Bin Rashid's clothes were a lot neater than his own. Although Gowden had been in the country only a couple of days, he was rumpled and coated in dust. And yet, Bin Rashid, who claimed to have lost everything in a catastrophic bombing, looked comparatively spiffy. But why would he lie about his clothes? Gowden couldn't sleep that night. He was so troubled by an improbable thought that played in his mind. The next morning, when the investigation resumed, Gowden asked the lead interrogator if he could ask a couple of questions.
"I spent 6 years in the Army," he told Bin Rashid.
He said that he had gone through specialized training in counter-interrogation techniques at the John F. Kennedy Special Warfare Center. It had been a brutal experience. Soldiers learned what to expect if they were ever taken prisoner. They were beaten and intimidated. They were also coached on how to tell a convincing cover story.
"I think you got the same training," Gowden asserted.
Now, if you remember your instruction, when you lie, you must tell a single logical story. But you made a mistake. You said one thing that was illogical. Instead of laughing in disbelief, Ben Rashid pulled his chair closer. Where was I illogical? He asked. Here's where your story falls apart, said Gowden, who was staring pointedly at Ben Rashid's shoes, which were scuffed and filthy like Gowden's own. You got cuts on both hands, but there's not a drop of blood on your green denim pants. In fact, you're perfectly clean. Arab men are much cleaner than American men, Ben Rashid responded. I'll give you that, said Gowden, still staring at his shoes. And maybe you've got a magic soap that gets the blood out of your clothes. Yes. You've got a gash on your back as well. I suppose there was some way a piece of glass fell from a building and went down your shirt without tearing it. Anything is possible, said Ben Rashid. I'll give you that, too. Then you wash your bloody shirt with your magic soap and it looks like new. But there are two things you don't wash. Ben Rashid followed Gowden's stare. Of course I don't wash my shoes. No, said Gowden, leaning forward and putting his hand on Ben Rashid's knee. But I said there were two things you don't wash, and here's where you forgot your training. Gowden stood up and put his hands on his belt, which was worn and faded. You don't wash a belt. Look at yours. It's pristine. Stand up and take it off. Ben Rashid stood up like a soldier obeying an order. As soon as he undid his belt, everyone in the room noticed the price tag. Although Ben Rashid quickly recovered his poise, the interrogation now moved to a different level. Gowden brought in John Antasev, one of the original members of the I-49 squad. Antasev has a calm manner, but his blue eyes are as vivid as searchlights. He began by politely asking if Ben Rashid had had a chance to pray. This led to a discussion of Sayyid Qutb, Abdullah Azam, and the blind sheikh. Ben Rashid relaxed. He seemed to relish the opportunity to lecture a Westerner about the importance of these men. They chatted until late in the evening. There's one other person we haven't talked about, Antasev observed, Osama bin Laden. Ben Rashid's eyes narrowed and he stopped talking. A small smile appeared on his face. Antasev, who had been listening like a captivated student, suddenly thrust a pen and paper into Ben Rashid's hand. Write down the first telephone number you called after the bombing. Once again, Ben Rashid obeyed the order. He wrote 967-1-200578, a number in Yemen. It belonged to a jihadi named Ahmed al-Hada. Ben Rashid had called the number both before and after the bombing, as had Osama bin Laden. Investigators quickly learned. This Yemeni telephone number would prove to be one of the most important pieces of information the FBI would ever discover, allowing investigators to map the links of the Al-Qaeda network all across the globe. After giving up the number, Ben Rashid stopped cooperating. Gowden and other agents decided to leave him alone, hoping he would think he wasn't so important to them. Meanwhile, they began to check out his story. They went to the hospital to see if they could find the doctor who treated his wounds, but there were nearly 5,000 injured the day of the bombing, and few of the staff remembered any faces in the sea of blood and pain. Then a janitor asked the agents if they had come because of the bullets and the keys he had found. The items had been stashed on a windowsill above a toilet stall. The key fit the model of truck used in the bombing. At the airport, the agents discovered Ben Rashid's landing card, which gave as his address in Nairobi the hotel where he had been discovered, so he was lying about the cab driver taking him there after the bombing. Phone records led them to a large villa where a call had been placed to the Hatta phone in Yemen half an hour before the bombing. When the evidence team arrived, their swabs lit up with explosive residue. It was here the bomb had been made. You want to blame this on me? Ben Rashid shouted when Gowden confronted him with the evidence. It's your fault, your country's fault, for supporting Israel. He was sputtering with fury. Flecks of foam were flying from his mouth. It was a startling turnaround from the controlled demeanor the investigators had witnessed for the past few days.
"My tribe is going to kill you and your entire family," he promised.
Gowden was also angry. The death toll had been rising all through the week as badly injured people succumbed to their awful wounds.
"Why did these people have to die?" he asked. "They had nothing to do with the United States and Israel and Palestine."
Bin Rashid didn't answer directly. Instead, he said something surprising. "I want to promise that I'll be tried in America, because America is my enemy, not Kenya. You give me that promise and I'll tell you everything." Gowden brought Patrick Fitzgerald, the prosecutor from the Southern District of New York, into the room. Fitzgerald drew up a contract pledging that the investigators would do everything in their power to get the suspect extradited to the United States. "My name is not Khalid Salim bin Rashid," the suspect now said. "I am Muhammad Al-Awali, and I'm from Saudi Arabia." He said he was 21 years old, well-educated, from a prominent merchant family. He had become very religious as a teenager, listening to sermons on audio cassettes and reading books and magazines that glorified martyrdom. A tape by Sheikh Safar Al-Hawali that talked about Kissinger's promise, a purported plan of former American Secretary of State Henry Kissinger's to occupy the Arabian Peninsula, particularly affected him. Inflamed by this spurious information, Awali made his way to Afghanistan to join the jihad. He took basic training at the Khaldan camp, learning how to use automatic weapons and explosives. Awali performed so well that he was granted an audience with bin Laden, who counseled him to get more instruction. Awali went on to learn techniques for kidnapping, hijacking planes and buses, seizing buildings, and gathering intelligence. Bin Laden kept an eye on him, reassuring him that he would eventually get a mission. While Awali was fighting with the Taliban, Jihad Ali came to him and said that they had finally been approved for a martyrdom operation, but it was to be in Kenya. Awali was crestfallen. "I want to attack inside the U.S., he pleaded. His handlers told him that the embassy strikes were important because they would keep America distracted while the real attack was being prepared. "We have a plan to attack the U.S., but we're not ready yet," the suspect told Gowden and the other investigators. "We need to hit you outside the country in a couple of places so you won't see what is going on inside. The big attack is coming. There's nothing you can do to stop it." Working for O'Neill sometimes felt like being in the mafia. The other agents observed that O'Neill's dress and manners, not to mention his Atlantic City background, gave him a mobbed-up air. The founding director of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, was sufficiently concerned about the young agent when he first entered the bureau that he drew O'Neill aside to ask about his connections. The only link was that O'Neill, like the mafia, was the product of a culture that thrived on personal loyalty. Nor was he above issuing threats to ruin the careers of agents who crossed him. After the embassy bombings, O'Neill scheduled meetings at 4 o'clock each afternoon, and typically he arrived as much as an hour late. His chronic tardiness aroused a lot of angry chatter among the married agents who had children to attend. O'Neill would finally enter the conference room, then go around the table and shake the hands of each team member, another time-consuming ritual. On one of these occasions, Jack Clunan, a member of the I-49 squad, kissed the massive FBI ring on O'Neill's finger. "Thank you, Godfather," he said. "Fuck you," O'Neill snapped. Dan Coleman was explaining a piece of intelligence in one of the meetings when O'Neill broke in. "You don't know what you're talking about," he said to the man, who more than anyone in America, with the exception of Mike Scheuer, had studied bin Laden and his organization. "Fine," said Coleman. "I'm just kidding." "You know what? I'm just Joe Shit the Ragman," Coleman said heatedly. "You're the SAC. I can't defend myself in a position like this." The next day, O'Neill came by Coleman's desk and apologized. "I shouldn't have done that," he said. Coleman accepted the apology, although he afforded himself the opportunity to lecture O'Neill on the responsibility of being a boss. O'Neill listened, then observed,
You look like you comb your hair with a hand grenade. Maybe I should use some of that oil you dump on your hair, said Coleman. O'Neill laughed and walked away. After that, Coleman slyly began to study O'Neill. The key, Coleman decided, was that he had come from nowhere. O'Neill's mother still drove a cab in Atlantic City during the day, and his father operated the same cab at night. O'Neill's uncle, a piano player, helped support them when the casino economy died. O'Neill had left home as soon as he could. On his first job, when he was a tour guide at FBI headquarters, he would carry a briefcase to work, as if he needed one, and he immediately attempted to exert control over the other guides. They resentfully called him Stinky because he was always in a sweat. Coleman had a sense of the empty space between the public O'Neill and the private one. The flashy suits, the gleaming fingernails, concealed a man of humble background and modest means. It was a front O'Neill could scarcely afford on a government salary. Belligerent and belittling at times, O'Neill was also anxious and insecure, frequently seeking reassurance and dragging a long tail of debt. Few knew how precarious his career was, how fragmented his private life, how unsettled his spirit. Once, when an agent got so angry at O'Neill in a meeting that he began screaming, O'Neill stalked out of the room and calmed himself down by making calls on his cell phone. "You can't do that," Coleman told the agent. "Tell him you're sorry. You didn't mean to disrespect him." O'Neill was as emotionally dependent on respect as any gangster. But he was also capable of extravagant and almost alarming gestures of caring, quietly raising money for victims of the bombings he investigated, and personally making sure his employees got the best doctors in the city when they fell ill. One of O'Neill's friends in Washington had bypass surgery during a blizzard. Traffic in the city was shut down, but he awakened to see O'Neill at his bedside. He had tramped through 18 inches of snow. Every morning he insisted on bringing coffee and a pastry to his secretary from a kiosk on the street, and he always remembered birthdays. These gestures, large and small, spoke to his own longing to be noticed and attended. 10 days after the embassy bombings, Jack Clunan got a call from one of his intelligence contacts in Sudan, telling him that 2 men involved in the case were in Khartoum. They had rented an apartment overlooking the American embassy there. Clunan gave the information to O'Neill, who called Dick Clark at the National Security Council the following day. "I want to work with the Sudanese," he told Clark. O'Neill was well aware that the country was on the State Department's terror list, but at least they were making an overture. "John, there's something I can't tell you," Clark said on the phone. He suggested that O'Neill come to Washington to talk to the Attorney General. She informed him that it was out of the question for him to work for the Sudanese. In a few hours, the United States was going to bomb that country in retaliation for the attacks on the embassies in East Africa. The missiles were already spinning in their tubes, preparatory to launch, in American warships stationed in the Red Sea. O'Neill landed in Washington the same day that Monica Lewinsky, a former White House intern, testified before a Washington grand jury that she had provided oral sexual favors for the President of the United States. Her story would be a deciding factor in the articles of impeachment that followed. In the minds of Islamists and, indeed, many Arabs, the relationship between the President and his intern perfectly symbolized Jewish influence in America. And any military response to the bombings was likely to be seen as an excuse to punish Muslims and divert attention from the scandal. "No war for Monica," was a sign seen in many Arab streets. But Clinton's crippled presidency offered him few options. The CIA suspected that bin Laden was developing chemical weapons in Sudan. The information had come from Jamal al-Fadl, bin Laden's former assistant, who was now a U.S. government witness. But Fadl had left Sudan 2 years before, about the same time that bin Laden had been expelled from the country. Unconvinced by the sincerity of the Sudanese government's repeated overtures to the United States to get itself removed from the State Department blacklist, the agency hired a spy from an Arab country to secure a soil sample from an area close to Al-Shifa,
a pharmaceutical plant suspected of being a secret chemical weapons facility and thought to be owned in part by bin Laden. The sample, taken in June 1998, purportedly showed traces of IMPTA, a chemical that was essential in making the extremely potent nerve gas VX. Indeed, it had few other uses. On August 20th, on the basis of this information, President Clinton authorized the firing of 13 Tomahawk cruise missiles into Khartoum as the first part of the American retaliation for the embassy bombings. The plant was completely destroyed. It developed that the plant actually made only pharmaceuticals and veterinary medicines, not chemical weapons. No other traces of IMPTA were ever found in or around the site. The chemical might have been a product of the breakdown of a commercially available pesticide widely used in Africa, which it closely resembles. Moreover, bin Laden had nothing to do with the plant. The result of this hasty strike was that the impoverished country of Sudan lost one of its most important manufacturers, which employed 300 people and produced more than half of the country's medicines, and a night watchman was killed. Sudan let the two accomplices in the East Africa bombings escape, and they've never been seen again. O'Neill and his team lost an invaluable opportunity to capture al-Qaeda insiders. At the same time that the warheads were exploding in northern Khartoum, 66 U.S. cruise missiles were in flight toward two camps around coast Afghanistan, near the Pakistan border. Zawahiri happened to be talking on bin Laden's satellite phone at the time to Rahimullah Yousafzai, a distinguished reporter for BBC and the Pakistani paper The News. Zawahiri told him, "Mr. bin Laden has a message. He says, 'I have not bombed the American embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. I have declared jihad, but I was not involved.'" The best way American intelligence had of detecting bin Laden's and Zawahiri's movements at the time was by tracking their satellite phone. If surveillance aircraft had been positioned in the region, Zawahiri's call to the reporter would have given agents his exact location. But the strike was delivered so quickly that there was little time to prepare. Still, American intelligence knew in general where bin Laden and Zawahiri were hiding, so the fact that surveillance aircraft were not available prior to the strike is inexplicable. Had they pinpointed Zawahiri prior to launch, there is little question that he would have been killed in the strike. On the other hand, it takes several hours to prepare a missile for firing, and the flight time from the warships in the Arabian Sea across Pakistan to eastern Afghanistan was more than 2 hours. By the time Zawahiri picked up the phone, the missiles were probably already on their way, and it was already too late. Although the National Security Agency was able to monitor calls on the satellite phone, it refused to share the raw data with the FBI or the CIA or Dick Clark in the White House. When the CIA learned from one of its own employees who was posted at the NSA that al-Qaeda's phones were being monitored, it demanded the transcripts. The NSA refused to hand them over. Instead, it offered narrative summaries that were often out of date. The CIA then turned to its own director of science and technology to construct a device that would monitor the transmissions of satellite phones from that portion of Afghanistan. They were able to receive only one side of the conversation, but based on one of the partial intercepts, the CIA determined that bin Laden and others were going to be in coast. The information was timely and relevant. Bin Laden had made the decision to go to coast only the night before, but as he and his companions were driving through Vardak province, they happened to pause at a crossroads. "Where do you think, my friends, we should go?" bin Laden asked. "Coast or Kabul?" His bodyguard and others voted for Kabul, where they could visit friends. "Then, with God's help, let us go to Kabul," bin Laden decreed, a decision that may have saved his life. At the age of 15, Abdulrahman Qadr was the youngest trainee in the Farouk camp near Khost. There were between 70 and 120 men training there, he estimated, and about an equal number in the Jihad Wall camp nearby. After the evening prayer, He was walking back from the washroom, carrying a bucket, when bright lights punctured the sky just above him. He threw the bucket aside, but before it hit the ground, the missiles began to explode. The first 20 explosions were at Jihad Wall. Abdul Rahman dove for cover as the next wave followed, detonating all around him. He glanced up to see the air pulsing with explosive waves. When the rain of rocks and pebbles subsided, he walked around the smoking ruins to see what was left. The administration building was destroyed. Abdul Rahman concluded that the trainers must be dead. But then he heard shouting, and he walked over to Jihad Wall, where he discovered that the trainers had gathered for a meeting. Amazingly, they were all alive. None of Al-Qaeda's leaders were harmed. There were 5 injured men, whom Abdul Rahman loaded into a 4x4. Despite his youth, he was the only one who could drive, so he rushed them to the hospital in Khost. He stopped along the way to give water to one of the badly injured, and the man died in his arms. Abdul Rahman returned to the camp to help bury the dead. One body was so mutilated it was impossible to identify. "Can you at least find his feet?" Abdul Rahman asked. Someone discovered one of them, and by the birthmark on a toe, Abdul Rahman was able to identify his friend, a Canadian citizen of Egyptian background like himself. There were 4 other dead men, whom they buried as surveillance aircraft flew overhead, recording the damage. In the big-chested parlance of U.S. military planners, the failed strikes were dubbed Operation Infinite Reach. Designed to be a surgical and proportional response to the terrorist acts, 2 bombings, 2 decisive replies. The missile attacks exposed the inadequacy of American intelligence and the futility of military power, which rained down nearly $750 million worth of armament on 2 of the poorest countries in the world. According to General Hamid Ghul, the former head of the ISI, more than half of the missiles fell in Pakistani territory, killing 2 Pakistani citizens. Although Abdul Rahman Qadr buried only 5 men in the Al-Qaeda camp, not counting the one who died in his arms, there were many false claims. Sandy Berger, Clinton's national security advisor, said that 20 or 30 Al-Qaeda operatives were killed. The Taliban later complained that 22 Afghans had also been killed and more than 50 gravely wounded. Bin Laden's bodyguard observed the damage, however, and agreed with Abdul Rahman's assessment. "Each house was hit by a missile, but they did not destroy the camp completely," he reported. "They hit the kitchen of the camp, the mosque, and some bathrooms. 6 men were killed, a Saudi, an Egyptian, an Uzbek, and 3 Yemenis." The attacks did have other profound consequences, however. Several of the Tomahawk missiles failed to detonate. According to Russian intelligence sources, bin Laden sold the unexploded missiles to China for more than $10 million. Pakistan may have used some of the ones found on its territory to design its own version of a cruise missile. The main legacy of Operation Infinite Reach, however, was that it established bin Laden as a symbolic figure of resistance, not just in the Muslim world, but wherever America, with the clamor of its narcissistic culture and the majestic presence of its military forces, had made itself unwelcome. When bin Laden's exhilarated voice came crackling across a radio transmission, "By the grace of God, I am alive," the forces of anti-Americanism had found their champion. Those Muslims who had objected to the slaughter of innocents in the embassies in East Africa were cowed by the popular support for this man whose defiance of America now seemed blessed by divine favor. Even in Kenya and Tanzania, the 2 countries that had suffered the most from Al-Qaeda's attacks, children would be spotted wearing bin Laden t-shirts. The day after the strikes, Zawahiri called Yousafzai again. "We survived the attack," Zawahiri informed him. "Tell the Americans that we aren't afraid of bombardment, threats, and acts of aggression. We suffered and survived the Soviet bombings for 10 years in Afghanistan, and we are ready for more sacrifices. The war has only just begun. The Americans should now await the answer.
Chapter 17. The New Millennium. 2 days after the American missile attacks, Mullah Omar placed a secret call to the U.S. State Department. He had a piece of advice. The strikes would only arouse anti-American sentiment in the Islamic world and provoke more acts of terrorism, he said. The best solution was for President Clinton to resign. The unflappable State Department official who fielded the call, Michael E. Malinowski, pointed out that there was considerable evidence that bin Laden was behind the bombings in East Africa. Malinowski added that he appreciated the tribal code that required Omar to shelter bin Laden, but the Saudi was behaving like a guest who was shooting at neighbors from the host's window. As long as bin Laden stayed in Afghanistan, Malinowski warned, there would be no reconstruction aid. Although the conversation resolved nothing, it was the first of many such candid and informal talks between the United States and the Taliban. Mullah Omar certainly realized that he had a problem. Bin Laden's declaration of war against the United States had split the Taliban. There were those who said that America had always been Afghanistan's friend, so why turn it into a powerful and unnecessary enemy? They pointed out that no one in bin Laden's inner circle, including bin Laden himself, had the religious authority to pronounce any fatwa, much less a jihad. Others felt that America had made itself Afghanistan's enemy when it launched the missiles. Omar was furious at bin Laden's defiance of his authority, but the American attack on Afghanistan's soil placed him in a quandary. If he surrendered bin Laden, he would be seen to be caving in to American pressure. He judged that the Taliban could not survive in power if he did so. And, of course, there was the deal that Mullah Omar had struck with Prince Turki, who would soon be returning to Kandahar to collect bin Laden and take him back to the kingdom. Once again, Omar summoned bin Laden. "I shed tears," bin Laden later admitted. "I told Mullah Omar that we would leave his country and head toward God's vast domain, but that we would leave our children and wives in his safekeeping. I said we would seek a land which was a haven for us." Mullah Omar said that things had not yet reached that stage. Bin Laden then made a pledge of personal fealty, much like the one that members of Al-Qaeda swore to him. He acknowledged Omar as the leader of the faithful. "We consider you to be our noble emir," bin Laden wrote. "We invite all Muslims to render assistance and cooperation to you in every possible way they can." With this promise in his pocket, Mullah Omar's attitude changed. He no longer viewed bin Laden as a threat. A friendship developed between them. From now on, when other members of the Taliban complained about the Saudi, Mullah Omar proved to be bin Laden's strongest defender. They often went fishing together below a dam west of Kandahar. "This time, why don't you come with me?" Prince Turki asked his Pakistani colleague, General Nasim Rana, head of the ISI, in mid-September. "That way, Mullah Omar can see that both of us are serious." On the basis of their own intelligence, the Pakistanis had informed Turki that bin Laden was behind the embassy bombings and that Saudi citizens had actually carried out the attack in Nairobi. Turki gloomily realized that he was no longer negotiating for a mere dissident, but for a master terrorist. Surely the Taliban's two strongest allies, Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, would be able to persuade the Afghan to surrender his nettlesome guest. Turki and General Rana came to the same Kandahar guesthouse where Mullah Omar had received the Saudi prince before. Turki greeted the Taliban ruler, then reminded him of his pledge. Before answering, Omar abruptly stood up and left the room for about 20 minutes. Turki wondered if he was consulting with his Shura council, or even with bin Laden himself. Finally, the leader of the faithful returned and said, "There must have been a translator's mistake. I never told you we would hand over bin Laden." "But, Mullah Omar, I did not say this only one time," Turki sputtered. He pointed to Omar's main advisor and de facto foreign minister,
Malawakal Ahmed Malawakal, who, Turkey remarked, had come to the kingdom only the month before to negotiate the handover. How could Omar pretend otherwise? Omar's voice was shrill, and he began to perspire. Turkey began to wonder if he was on drugs. Omar screamed at the prince, telling him that bin Laden was a man of honor, a man of distinction, who only wanted to see the Americans run out of Arabia. Instead of seeking to persecute him, you should put your hand in ours and his and fight against the infidels. He called Saudi Arabia an occupied country and became so personally insulting that the translator hesitated. I'm not going to take any more of this, Turkey said furiously. But you must remember, Mullah Omar, what you are doing now is going to bring a lot of harm to the Afghan people. Turkey and General Rana rode back to the airport in stunned silence. It was particularly galling to once again pass by Tarnak Farms, bin Laden's dilapidated citadel. From now on, not only Turkey's personal reputation, but also Saudi Arabia's place in the world would be held hostage by the man inside. Although the American strike had damaged the Afghan training camps, they were easily relocated, this time near the population centers of Kandahar and Kabul. But the attack had left a residue of paranoia, and the members of the Al-Qaeda community, who were always suspicious of outsiders, turned on each other. Saif al-Adl, the head of bin Laden's security force, was certain that there was a traitor in his camp. After all, bin Laden and key members of the Shura Council would have been in Khost when the missile struck, had it not been for the last-minute decision to turn off on the road to Kabul. Bin Laden still sat with the men in his same casual manner, and it was easy for anyone to approach him. On one occasion, a Sudanese named Abu al-Sha'atha came into the circle and spoke rudely to bin Laden in front of the other leaders. One of the men, Abu Jandal, recognized the man as a Takfiri and offered to sit between him and bin Laden. There is no need, bin Laden assured him, but he put his hand on his pistol while he talked. When the Sudanese Takfiri made a sudden movement, Abu Jandal pounced on him and pulled his hands behind his back, sitting on the man until he could no longer move. Bin Laden laughed and said, "Abu Jandal, let the man be." But bin Laden and his Egyptian security men had been impressed by the alertness and strength of this loyal follower. Bin Laden gave Abu Jandal a pistol and made him his personal bodyguard. There were only two bullets in the gun, meant to kill bin Laden in the face of capture. Abu Jandal took care to polish the bullets every night, telling himself, "These are Sheikh Osama's bullets. I pray to God not to let me use them." After the humiliation of Prince Turkey by Mullah Omar, both the Taliban and bin Laden's security force were on edge about an expected Saudi response. The Taliban caught a young Uzbek in Khost who was acting strangely. His name was Sadiq Ahmed, and he had grown up in the kingdom as an expatriate. He admitted that Prince Salman, the governor of Riyadh, had hired him to kill bin Laden. Prince Salman denies this. In return, the assassin would receive 2 million Saudi rials and Saudi citizenship. Did you expect that you would be able to kill Sheikh Osama bin Laden and escape from 14 highly trained guards armed with automatic weapons? Abu Jandal demanded. The boy was only 18, but he looked like a child. "I made a mistake," he cried. He was dazed and pathetic. Finally, bin Laden said, "Release him." In early February 1999, bin Laden floated into Mike Scheuer's sights once again. The CIA received intelligence that bin Laden was camping with a group of Royal Falconers from the United Arab Emirates in the desert south of Kandahar. The tip came from the bodyguard of one of the princes. They were hunting the Hubara bustard, an endangered bird legendary for its speed and cunning, as well as its potency as an aphrodisiac. The princes arrived in a C-130, carrying generators, refrigerated trucks, elaborate air-conditioned tents, towering masts for their communications equipment and televisions, and nearly 50 4x4 pickups, which they would leave behind for their Taliban hosts as gratuities. Sure, you could see the encampment vividly on reconnaissance photos. He could even make out the falcons roosting on their poles, but he could not find bin Laden's smaller camp, which he knew must be nearby. Whenever bin Laden set foot in the royal camp, the Emirati bodyguard would report to his American handler in Pakistan, and the information would be on Shoyer's desk within the hour. Afghan spies placed in a wide circle around the camp confirmed the Saudis' comings and goings. Shoyer is tall and rumpled, with glasses and a bristling brown beard. One can imagine his portrait on the wall of a 19th-century Prussian estate. He is a driven and demanding person, who sleeps only a few hours a night. Coleman used to notice the employee sign-in sheets with 2:30 a.m. or some such hour marked by Shoyer's name. He would usually linger till 8 at night. A pious Catholic of the type Coleman knew well, Shoyer had a cold attachment about the job he needed to do. Only a couple of months before, Shoyer had gotten intelligence that bin Laden would be spending the night in the governor's residence in Kandahar. When Shoyer proposed an immediate cruise missile strike, the military objected, saying that as many as 300 people might die, and a nearby mosque would likely be damaged. Such considerations enraged Shoyer. Convinced that the sighting in the Bustard camp was the best chance he would ever get to assassinate bin Laden, Shoyer accompanied CIA Director George Tenet to meet with Dick Clark in the White House. Once again, the Pentagon was readying cruise missiles, America's chosen means of assassination, for a strike the following morning. Coincidentally, Clark had recently returned from the Emirates, where he had helped negotiate the sale of American-built fighter aircraft worth $8 billion. He had personal ties to the UAE royal family. No doubt the image of dead princes scattered in the sand played in his mind, along with the failures of Operation Infinite Reach. Moreover, the CIA could not guarantee that bin Laden was actually in the camp. Clark rejected the mission. Tenet also voted against it. Shoyer felt betrayed. The considerations that turned the men against the project seemed petty and mercenary compared to the opportunity to kill bin Laden. "I'm not a big consequences guy," Shoyer admitted. And to prove it, he sent out a series of wounded, recriminating emails. Talk in the hallways of the agency suggested that he had suffered a breakdown, that his obsession with bin Laden had gotten the best of him. In the meantime, he blew up at a senior FBI manager in Alex Station, which elicited an angry phone call from Director Free to Tenet. In May, Shoyer was dismissed as the head of Alec. "You're burned out," his boss told him. He was expected to retire and accept the intelligence medal that had been struck for him. "Stick it in your ass," said Shoyer. He reported at his usual dizzying time on Monday morning and occupied a desk in the library. He remained there month after month, with no duties, waiting for the agency to come to him when it was ready to kill, not to dither over a few dead princes. O'Neill's office was in the northeast corner of the 25th floor of New York's 26th Federal Plaza, overlooking the Chrysler and Empire State Buildings through one window and the Brooklyn Bridge through the other. He made sure that there was no other FBI office like it. He cleaned out the prison-made government-issue furniture and brought in a lavender couch. On his flame mahogany coffee table was a book about tulips, the flower that drives men wild, and he filled the room with plants and seasonal cut flowers. He kept two computers, one the antiquated and handicapped version supplied by the Bureau, and the other his own high-speed PC. In the background, CNN ran constantly on a small television. Instead of the usual family pictures that adorn office walls and desktops, O'Neill had prints of French Impressionists. Few people in the Bureau knew that he had a wife and two children, John Jr. and Carol, in New Jersey, who did not join him when he moved to Chicago in 1991. Shortly after he arrived in that city, he met Valerie James, a fashion sales director who was divorced and had two children of her own. She was tall and beautiful, with a level gaze and a sultry voice. She saw O'Neill at a bar and bought him a drink because he had the most compelling eyes. They stayed up talking till 5 in the morning. O'Neill sent Valerie flowers every